Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, more outdoor events are canceled and millions of Americans are warned to stay indoors as eastern states are blanketed by smoke from Canadian wildfires.
President Biden meets with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom amid challenges on Ukraine, artificial intelligence, and a host of other matters.
And the head of UNICEF on the devastating impact wars are having on children around the world.
There are about 400 million children who are living in some situation of conflict. So it's a staggering problem for children in so many parts of the world.
Welcome to the NewsHour. A heavy pall of polluted air still blankets much of the eastern U.S. tonight. It may not dissipate for days as fires in Canada send vast curtains of smoke drifting south.
The bad air has officials warning, in effect, that breathing can be hazardous to your health. It's also scrambling schedules from airports to schools to the White House. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
A huge swath of the country spent another day shrouded in haze. This morning, smoke still obscured parts of the Manhattan skyline.
The smoke obliterated the island yesterday, so it's obviously not just a passing phase, you know, of wind changes, but it's serious pollution in the air.
As hundreds of wildfires rage out of control in Canada, winds have carried the smoke farther south, all the way to Raleigh, North Carolina, which woke up to hazy skies. And in the nation's capital, a blanket of smoke lay over the White House, blurring the Washington Monument in the distance. White House officials postponed tonight's outdoor pride celebration until Saturday. Millions of people were under hazardous air quality advisories today from the Northeast to the South and parts of the Midwest. Authorities advise people to stay indoors, especially young children, the elderly, and those with respiratory issues.
Level of danger compared to
allergy and immunology specialist Dr. Purvi Parikh described the health risks.
The wildfire smoke has particulate matter that's very, very small, and that small particulate matter can really get lodged deep into your lungs, so it can cause a lot more lung damage in the short term and long term. And in addition to these particles, wildfire smoke has a variety of gases too that can be harmful to breathe in.
New York State is making a million N95 masks available to the public, including 400,000 for New York City.
Just want to make sure that we're being as safe as we can to protect our health.
The city's mayor, Eric Adams, has gone door to door distributing masks to residents. He says the worst of the air may be behind the city.
The smoke models are not indicating another large plume over the city. So there's a chance for significant improvement by tomorrow morning and throughout the day tomorrow.
Even so, New York City announced that public schools will teach remotely tomorrow. Meantime, poor visibility prompted the Federal Aviation Administration to cancel or delay flights into New York area airports and Philadelphia's international airport. The dangerous air quality also canceled or postponed more sporting events, from racing at Belmont Park in New York to the Washington Nationals' home baseball game.
Observation.
New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said the harmful impact of the fires is further proof that we must do more to tackle the climate crisis.
Climate change is here, and unfortunately, this is our new reality. That disturbing orange haze in the sky, that smell of smoke, and that burning in our throats. Those are clear warning signs that the status quo cannot continue.
Paul Ulrich, a professor of regional climate modeling at UC Davis, agrees.
We are experiencing warmer conditions and experiencing more extremes. Every year, we have some manifestation of that, whether it be an extreme tropical cyclone, an extreme wildfire, tornado outbreaks, or other forms of extreme weather. So the evidence is continuing to pile up that we are having a clear impact on the climate system. And as a consequence, the climate system is having an impact on us.
With more than 400 wildfires still burning in Canada, forecasters warn the smoke could linger over the eastern U.S. through the weekend. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
In the day's other news, Ukraine charged that Russian shelling disrupted rescue efforts for victims of the dam collapse. The attacks struck in and around the southern city of Kherson. Stark new drone footage today shows the catastrophic flooding that's killed at least 14 people and forced more than 4,000 others to flee.
I live on the third floor. The water covers the ground floor. This morning, when it was up to my knees, I was afraid that if it rises even more, I will not be able to leave at all. That's why I decided to evacuate.
Meantime, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky toured the flooded western bank of the Dnipro River. He called for a swift global response. The Biden administration today dismissed reports that Cuba may let China set up an electronic eavesdropping base on the island. The Wall Street Journal and others reported the facility could gather intelligence on military bases across the southeastern U.S. Both the White House and the Pentagon challenged the reports.
I can tell you, based on the information that we have, that that is not accurate, that we are not aware of China and Cuba developing any type of spy station. Separately, I would say that the relationship that those two countries share is something that we continuously monitor.
Cuba called the reports unfounded. The Journal account said China had agreed in principle to pay Cuba several billion dollars to let it establish the spying post. Taiwan scrambled fighter jets today as dozens of Chinese warplanes flew near the self-ruled island. Taipei said 37 Chinese aircraft entered a defense zone that it monitors, crossing the southwest corner. They included nuclear-capable bombers. It was China's latest mass flight into the defense zone in recent years. Beijing claims Taiwan as its own. In France, a man with a knife stabbed four young children and two adults at a public playground in the Alps. The children, 22 months to 3 years old, were critically wounded. It happened in a lakeside town south of Geneva. Emergency workers cordoned off the park and local residents expressed shock.
It will take time until parents again take their children to playground, since I think the trauma will stay forever in the town of Annecy. Everyone expects this to happen in big cities like Marseille, Paris, or Lyon. But now the target will be places where no one expects it, to put fear into people.
Police arrested a 31-year-old Syrian refugee as the attacker. A local prosecutor said his motive was unclear, but did not appear to be terrorism. Back in this country, the U.S. House of Representatives shut down as a Republican revolt blocked any action. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy called off the week's remaining sessions as he tries to end a standoff with hardline party conservatives. The rebellion focuses on budget compromises in the debt ceiling deal. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 168 points to close at 33,833. The NASDAQ rose 133 points, or 1%. The S&P 500 added 26 points and entered bull market territory, 20% above its low last fall. Still to come on the NewsHour, the U.S. Supreme Court forces Alabama to redraw congressional districts that advocates say discriminate against black voters. We look at the cultural and political influence of the late Christian broadcaster Pat Robertson and legendary Broadway composer John Kander on his latest musical that's a love letter to New York.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden hosted the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak today at the White House. It was Sunak's first Oval Office visit since taking office last fall. The two leaders discussed continued support for Ukraine and the potential threats posed by artificial intelligence. Our White House correspondent Laura Barone Lopez was there in the room. She is here now to discuss it all. Good to see you, Laura.
Good to be here.
So we know military aid to Ukraine was a top agenda item in that meeting. All of that was unfolding as there is now a very public rift among Republicans on Capitol Hill about whether or not to continue supporting and providing additional support for Ukraine. Did the two leaders address that at all?
They did talk about that. So as you know, Amna, this meeting was happening as Ukraine's counteroffensive began in earnest. And Britain's prime minister talked repeatedly about what Britain has done to date, specifically that they have helped Ukraine train troops, that they are one of the most helpful European nations in terms of giving including Ukraine aid. But as you noted, this is happening as Republicans on the Hill are very split about whether or not they want to vote in support of more aid to Ukraine. President Biden was asked about his confidence in whether or not he has the votes for more aid.
I believe we'll have the funding necessary to support Ukraine as long as it takes. And I believe that that support will be real, even though there are, you hear some voices today on Capitol Hill about whether or not we should continue to support Ukraine.
So President Biden there voicing a lot of confidence. That also is in addition to the fact that Prime Minister Sunak visited the Hill this week. He met with congressional leaders, Republican and Democrats, and he also spoke to some chairs on committees about the need for more U.S. aid to Ukraine. And at that press conference, Amna, he specifically said that U.S. resources, U.S.'s aid to the Ukraine is, quote, a decisive contribution that helps democracy prevail.
Prime Minister Sunak also made artificial intelligence, or AI, a key part of this visit. You had a chance to ask him a question. You asked him about how to responsibly regulate the technology. What did he say?
He dodged a little bit, Amna. He didn't quite give specifics about how exactly the U.K. or the U.S. would regulate this technology. And he acknowledged on one hand that it brings benefits to the economy, to the society. He also acknowledged the very grave dangers that AI poses. And he appears to want to create a governing body around AI. He announced in this press conference that he is going to be holding a global AI summit later this year in the UK. President Biden also, though, added a little bit of specifics, saying that he thinks that there's some potential for the administration to look at how watermarks on everything produced by AI could potentially be a part of this. And we spoke to an expert about whether or not that's a real possibility. And they said that it really isn't, given the fact that this software is out there so much that it can be essentially manipulated by a lot of people that have access to it.
A lot of shared concerns on the AI front, for sure. You also had a chance to ask President Biden a question, and he made some news when you asked him about the ramping up of Republican attacks on LGBTQ rights here. What did he say?
So I mentioned to the president that across Republican states in this country, there are bans being passed on gender-affirming care. I also noted the protests that are occurring in states like California, anti-LGBTQ protests. And I told President Biden about the parents of a transgender girl in Texas that I recently interviewed and their fears and the fact that they are considering that they may need to move not just out of Texas, but also out of the country. And I asked the president why he thought this was happening and what he would say to that family.
When we finish this, you can give me the number of that family and I will call them. Let them know that the president and this administration has their back. Our fight is far, far from over because we have some hysterical and, I would argue, prejudiced people who are engaged in all what you see going on around the country.
That's some of the harshest comments you've heard from the president to date about anti-transgender efforts. His administration also announced some actions that they're taking today, including a new education department official who will be helping communities that are confronting book bans about gender identity.
Great questions in the room. Great reporting as always. Our White House correspondent, Laura Barrón López. Thank you.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court today struck down Republican-drawn congressional districts in Alabama that civil rights activists say discriminated against black voters. The ruling was a surprising departure from court opinions over the past decade, narrowing the scope of the Voting Rights Act. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority opinion and was joined by the three liberal justices, as well as conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh. To help us understand the significance of all this, we're joined by NewsHour Supreme Court analyst Marcia Coyle and redistricting expert David Wasserman of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. With a welcome to you both, Marcia, we'll start with you. The Chief Justice, in the opinion, wrote that there were legitimate concerns that the Voting Rights Act, quote, may impermissibly elevate race in the allocation of political power within the states, but he added, our opinion today does not diminish or disregard these concerns. It simply holds that a faithful application of our precedents and a fair reading of the record before us do not bear them out here. What is the court saying with this ruling?
I think the Chief Justice is saying that the majority is aware that whenever you deal with racial classifications, whether it's in redistricting or in other contexts, there is that concern that race may dominate. And so he's reassuring everyone that there really is a totality of circumstances test for Section 2, and that the court's precedents in this area have imposed limitations that protect against race actually dominating in redistricting. And that has been the case for some 40 years. Section 2 claims, he pointed out, are extremely hard to win in federal courts, and they haven't been winning. So he's saying that there are safeguards here, but he is aware that they're dealing with race.
And David, this ruling was seen as a surprise, given one, the conservative makeup of this court, and two, the ways in which the court, as we mentioned in previous rulings, has really hollowed out the Voting Rights Act. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund, an attorney with that organization, argued the case before the court. And in a statement today, the organization said this decision is a clear message to lawmakers that their responsibility has not changed. They must ensure that voters of color are not denied an opportunity to participate in the electoral process. Is that how you see it? What are your takeaways from this ruling?
I am somewhat surprised. I can't say I'm shocked, because the initial decision by the federal court panel to strike down Alabama's congressional map was handed down by two Trump appointees on that panel. But look, at once, this is an application of longtime precedent, but it's also a sea change politically, because Alabama's only had one black majority district since 1992. And it was only in the last decade that black Democratic politicians and other Democrats began to question this kind of configuration of districts. Now we're likely to see additional, more proportional maps enacted in Louisiana as well. There will be cases that play out in Georgia, potentially South Carolina, Texas, that could net Democrats an additional 2 to 4 seats in the House. And that could put them in closer contention for House control, given how narrow Republicans' margin is today.
Well, let's talk more about that, because we have a map that shows the number of states where their congressional districts are now being litigated. And this decision is going to force many of these states, it'll force every state, really, to think about how they redraw congressional lines in areas that have a significant black population. Is that right?
Well, not just black voters, but Hispanic voters in some cases as well. Keep in mind that Republicans thought they had a bit of an insurance policy heading into 2024 in the House, because they captured control of the North Carolina Supreme Court, which has cleared the path for the Republican legislature there to re-gerrymander the state's boundaries in a way that could net Republicans an additional 3 seats. This ruling offsets that, and it could actually impact Republicans' thinking in North Carolina and make them more risk-averse to the threat of a Voting Rights Act lawsuit, and that could force them to draw a less ambitious plan. At the same time, New York Democrats believe that the judiciary in that state has turned in their favor, and some of them are pushing to redraw the state's political boundaries in a way that's advantageous to Democrats. We could see a net benefit in redistricting for Democrats prior to the 2024 election, and that's quite different from what we thought would be the case a couple months ago.
Marcia, looking at this ruling, what should we see as the significance, if at all, of Chief Justice John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh siding with the liberals?
I wasn't surprised the Chief Justice ended up in the majority, or even that he wrote it, because he has been out front on all of the court's major race-related decisions, not just the redistricting context. Justice Kavanaugh, you know, he hedged a bit in that stay decision last year, so we weren't really sure, you know, where he would come out. But I think the Chief Justice's ability to put together majorities in closely contested cases really does seem to hinge more and more on whether Justice Kavanaugh will join him in taking either a more restrained opinion than the other conservatives in the majority, or just to join with the court's 3 liberal justices. So it's that, you know, sort of plan perhaps for the future that Kavanaugh becomes the median justice and the key to whether Roberts can get what he wants when faced with five conservatives who may not want to go along with him.
Marcia Coyle and David Wasserman, our thanks to you both.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Famed religious broadcaster Pat Robertson has died. The TV host and one-time presidential candidate left a lifetime of achievements and controversies behind. Lisa Desjardins has our look at his life and legacy.
In Jesus' name.
A pioneer, Pat Robertson was one of the nation's most prominent televangelists and shaped conservative politics and controversy for decades. Few people were more influential in the rise of the religious right.
Even as the framers of our Constitution gave our forefathers a vision of a new land blessed with liberty, I would like for all of us on this special day to hold out a new vision for America.
Robertson was born in Virginia in 1930 and saw politics early. His father, a conservative Democrat, spent decades in Congress. After serving in the Korean War, he went to law school. Then a turn, a religious awakening took him to ministry, and he uprooted his wife and young family for a leap of faith. In 1960, he purchased a small TV station in Virginia Beach, saying the Lord told him to start the Christian Broadcasting Network, or CBN.
He was a towering figure.
John Jessup is CBN's main anchor today.
The 700 Club.
Where Robertson's 700 Club, named for 700 original pledging viewers, is still the flagship. Robertson created a global network, but didn't stop there. He looked to shape minds and, in the 1970s, founded the private Christian Regent University, as well as a national legal foundation.
It shows his business acumen to a certain extent. You know, he was someone that I would call maybe a serial entrepreneur.
But Robertson wanted a wider reach.
It's pretty early to be talking presidential politics for 1988, but the people who do have started including the name of Pat Robertson in the list of possible Republicans.
His White House bid was a long shot, but he found his base, Christian conservative voters, and finished second in the Iowa caucuses.
I entered the race so I might speak out on great moral issues confronting our nation, and I entered the race to win. I did not win.
Robertson turned his failed presidential campaign into a movement, launching the Christian Coalition, reaching directly to churches, that reshaped politics in America and was pivotal in the 1994 GOP takeover of the U.S. House.
Pat Robertson was crucial to building the evangelical movement into a political constituency.
John Ward is chief national correspondent for Yahoo News.
Thank you and God bless you.
He knows Robertson was a figure revered by millions, but he was equally controversial and seen as fueling hatred at times with anti-LGBTQ rhetoric and attacking other religions as demonic. Robertson implied that Hurricane Katrina was punishment for abortion in America, and he publicly agreed with the idea that September 11th was God's rebuke for America moving left.
Those comments that he made, I think, came from, in part, that sense of wanting to be an all-or-nothing type of believer, as well as wanting to interpret or just coming from a corner of Christianity where the Bible is interpreted in a quite literal fashion.
Robertson also claimed God would intervene after President Donald Trump's 2020 election loss.
We declared on this program, and you joined with me, that God Almighty was going to do a miracle and stop the theft of our election.
But shifted gears a few weeks later.
The president still lives in an alternate reality. I think it would be well to say, you've had your day, and it's time to move on.
He was not always predictable, as when he teamed up with Democrat Al Sharpton for a message about climate change.
And we strongly disagree.
Except on one issue. Tell him what it is, Reverend Pat.
That would be our planet.
Robertson stepped down from hosting the 700 Club in 2021 after a series of health issues. But he continued to comment on politics and religion until his death. Pat Robertson was 93 years old. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
A new report released by UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, contains an appalling statistic. Each day, 20 children are killed or maimed in conflicts around the world. That's since they began recording data in 2005. A staggering 315,000 grave violations against children have been verified by the UN. Thousands of children have been abducted, recruited into armed conflicts, and subjected to sexual violence in global conflicts over the last two decades. Now, this is a very tough subject and a warning. We should say some viewers may be disturbed by some of the details in the conversation I had earlier about this report with UNICEF's executive director, Catherine Russell. Help us understand the context here. How do you gather these numbers? And are these conservative estimates or worst case scenarios?
I think you make such a good point, which is these are quite conservative estimates. These are cases of where we can actually verify what happened, which means we're sure there are many, many more children who are suffering. And these grave violations are everything from children who are killed to seriously injured to abducted to sexually violated. I mean, it's just a horrific list of challenges that children face around the world. And I have to say, our estimates now are there are about 400 million children who are living in some situation of conflict at this, even today as we speak. So it's a staggering problem for children in so many parts of the world.
These do stretch over about 20 years that you looked at. Have these numbers been getting worse over the years, or have they remained steady?
You know, somehow the number of conflicts keeps increasing. The thing that's gotten the most attention in the last year has been the conflict in Ukraine. But the problem is none of the conflicts ever really seem to go away. So we're still looking at challenges in Syria, for example, in Yemen. These places are persistent challenges, and children, in every situation of war, children suffer the most. I mean, that's just the reality that we have to deal with. And some of it is direct suffering, where they're injured directly, landmines, attacks, things like that. In other cases, they suffer because the systems that they rely on, education, healthcare, water, are destroyed so often in conflict.
Catherine, you yourself have traveled to Ukraine and Syria and Yemen. Tell us about some of the children you've met and what they're facing there.
You know, the wonderful thing about it is almost everywhere I go, I see children who just really desperately want to be children, you know, and you'll see them and they'll start playing a game or playing tag with each other. But I've also seen so many horrific situations and heard so many terrible stories. I remember one, I was at a hospital in the Democratic Republic of the Congo where they treat children and women, actually, who have suffered some sort of sexual violence typically, and they have something called fistulas, which is a physical problem that results from very vicious rapes. And I saw one little girl who was so cute. She was playing. I assumed that she was a child of one of the women who was there being treated. And I talked to the doctor there, and he said, oh, no, she was, she was a patient. He said it was one of the hardest things he's ever had to do was to really put her back together after she had been just viciously sexually violated. And you have to wonder, you know, why? How could anyone do that to a four-year-old baby? So I've seen that. I've seen children in Ukraine who are suffering from the after effects of the constant shelling. I met a family where the son was quite disabled, severely disabled, and every time those sirens would go off, the alarms would go off, he would completely fall apart. And so the family, because he was bigger, even though he was sort of childlike, they couldn't get him into the bomb shelters. And so, you know, persistently the family was just trying so hard to protect this child, this son, but also unable to do that given what was going on. So I've seen just countless stories like this, and it is truly, it's a situation where you see just, you know, how horrific human beings can be to each other, and that when that happens to children, it's just particularly hard to deal with.
Catherine, it's unimaginable what you're describing children are enduring around the world. As part of your report, you project an alarming funding gap as well, a projected shortfall of $835 million in 2024, nearly $1 billion by 2026. What is it those funds go towards? I mean, in these circumstances, how is it you can support these children short of ending the war or the conflict?
Yeah. Well, you put your finger on it, right? First of all, the worst thing that can happen to children is a war. Children don't start wars. They are unable to end wars. They just suffer in wars. So what we do is, in the context of something that's already terrible, which is what children are facing, we try to help put them back together in a sense, right? We give them psychosocial support. Often we give them physical, you know, medical support if they've suffered, which many children have. I mean, I saw one child in Yemen who'd lost both his legs. I mean, it was so sad and so painful to see. So we help on that side. We also importantly try to make sure these children are still getting educated. You know, a lot of times in a conflict, as I said, the services aren't happening. And so children, in addition to being in the middle of a war, are also not getting an education, which sets them back so far. So we provide education services, we provide water, we provide sanitation, all the basic needs that we possibly can for children. But at the end of the day, you know, once they're in that situation, it's already horrible for them, right? We're trying to make the best of a bad situation and trying to help them recover from a situation that they shouldn't have been in the first place.
With a growing number of children in these situations, if this kind of support is not provided for them, what do you worry will happen for this generation of children?
Yeah. Well, you can imagine. I mean, I've seen in some situations what happens. These children just get lost. You know, they are not getting educated. They have terrible physical problems. A lot of times they end up, you know, in many places it's hard for children who are disabled, you know, whether from war or otherwise. But when they're disabled in war, a lot of times they don't, even as the society starts to come together, these children are often not included in schools and other activities. It's challenging to raise resources for issues like this because I think in a way, you know, the world community looks at it and they think, well, this is just kind of what happens. And it's not, you know, these conflicts go on for so long that people kind of tire of it. And I think it is important to remind the world, and that's why this report is important, to say, don't forget these children. You know, they are blameless here, and they deserve an opportunity to live a decent life, and we have to do everything we can to help them.
As you've said, children shouldn't pay the price for the wars of adults. That is Catherine Russell, Executive Director of UNICEF, joining us tonight. Catherine, thank you so much.
Broadway's big night, the Tony Awards, will be held this Sunday. The new show, New York, New York, is a top contender, nominated in 9 categories, including Best Musical. The composer of its music, John Kander, is separately being honored with a special award for Lifetime Achievement in the Theater. Quite a life, extraordinary achievement, which continues. Jeffrey Brown joined Kander at the piano in his New York, New York home for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
They're cheering for me now. In my mind, they're cheering for me now.
The new Broadway musical, New York, New York, set shortly after World War II, opens with a song called Cheering for Me Now, in which we meet characters who've come to New York with uncertain futures but big dreams. The show is a love letter to a city. And for its 96-year-old composer, John Kander, it captures the wonder of working with others to create something new.
I've lived a long time, and one of the good things I can tell you about living a long time is that you keep finding out things and learning things about not just your own life, about life itself, or what really matters. And I found myself at the end of the workshop of New York, New York, saying to the company and thanking them that one of the greatest pleasures in life was making art with your friends.
Kander, who grew up in Kansas City, was himself one of those people who came to post-war New York to make it. He did big time, and it was through the collaborative process, as half of one of musical theater's greatest teams. Music by John Kander, lyrics by Fred Ebb.
Yes, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz.
Creators of such blockbusters as Chicago, which premiered in 1975. A 1996 revival is now the longest running show on Broadway. Another classic, Cabaret, from 1966, later a film starring Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey.
Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
They wrote 16 Broadway musicals in all, and thousands of songs, including a certain anthem that pretty much everyone on the planet must have heard and most can sing along with.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today.
I'll make a brand new start of it.
In old New York.
It was originally written for the 1977 film drama New York, New York, directed by Martin Scorsese. And as the story goes, when star Robert De Niro didn't much like the first version Kander and Ebb brought them, the two went off and did what they did best. Sat at the piano and got to work.
We went home pissed off.
Yeah. About what?
Yes.
That De Niro didn't like your song.
Yeah. It's true. And we went into this little room where we work with Freddie and sat down and said, well, let's do it again. And my hands, while we were talking, went. And with Fred, immediately inside of that vamp is and pretty, and the very first lines.
In fact, Kander says music is always playing in his head, even as we talked. His job, improvise until he finds the good parts, while Fred Ebb, who died in 2004, was doing the same with an endless string of words.
He could, and this is brilliant, and a lot of people, I don't know a lot of people who can do this, he could improvise in rhyme and meter in the same way that I could do. Without thinking, seemingly without thinking.
So you're right. You're improvising at the keyboard, and he's improvising with the rhymes in his head, and somehow it comes together.
Right. It is mysterious because it's. I think it's so deeply unconscious.
The new New York, New York musical, directed and choreographed by Susan Stroman, another longtime Kander collaborator, is loosely based on the earlier film, with new characters and storylines.
When I heard you sing, it changed everything.
At its heart, a young musician played by Colton Ryan, who lost his brother in the war, and a singer played by Anna Uzelli, facing racial discrimination as she struggles for opportunities. Many of the songs are older ones by Kander and Ebb. 7 were written with a new partner and friend, contemporary Broadway giant Lin-Manuel Miranda, who joined the cast and production team in a rousing 96th birthday song for Kander.
Happy birthday to you.
We have a good time working together, and it reminds me a little bit of Freddie because Lin is very fast, and I'm very fast.
Fast as in, like, the ideas are coming quickly?
Yeah, it's, and again, the ideas can be terrible.
Yeah.
And nobody is a bad person because they have it. But so you write it and then you change it.
So there's a lot of craft to songwriting, right?
Yes, and that's the word. I think we're all carpenters.
Knowing how to put it together.
Yeah, it's one thing to want to make art. It's another to do it, and that's craft. You get better at it, hopefully. As you were, or not. The rehearsal room is for me the safest place in the world because you can do anything. You can be so terrible, but it's private.
Yeah.
And eventually you end up in the rehearsal room with something that's as close as you can get to what you intended.
Even with New York, New York now on Broadway, Kander, who lives with his husband Albert Stevenson, was about to leave after our talk to join a workshop session for a potential revival of the Kander and Ebb 1990 musical, Kiss of the Spider Woman. He is very much still at it.
My mother had a great phrase, which none of us understood until late in life. She said, you do the best you can, a horse can't do any better.
A horse can't do any better.
I understand now what that means. In other words, if you're writing a show, you do the best you can, sometimes without thinking of the ramifications.
You are 96 and still working. Right. What's the secret?
Well, are you supposed to stop doing the things that give you pleasure? Who wrote that rule?
Well, no one wrote that rule, certainly not for John Kander. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in New York, New York.
Come on, come through.
We will be back shortly with some words of advice from college graduation speakers.
But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps keep programs like this one on the air.
For those of you staying with us, we revisit a piece of complicated medical history. Special correspondent Fred DeSam Lazaro has our encore report from Alabama's capital of Montgomery. It's part of his series, Agents for Change.
Welcome to More Than a Tour.
For some years, Michelle Browder has conducted trolley tours of Montgomery.
This is her apartment, so I would invite you to get out.
From Rosa Parks' home to the bus depot that's now the Freedom Rides Museum.
This is where they were beaten and bludgeoned, right here.
Alabama's Capitol is a living history museum of the civil rights era, with so many iconic events, people, and places.
Buses are coming! Oh.
But for Browder, artist by training, activist by leaning, there's one chapter of an earlier history that she's working to rewrite. It's manifest in a monument on the Capitol grounds to James Marion Sims. He was a physician who practiced here in the 1840s, developing tools for pelvic exams and a technique to suture vaginal tears called fistulas. To Michelle Browder, that's only half the story.
There's nothing on the monument now that says anything about the women that he worked on.
Oh, absolutely not. Nothing of these 11 enslaved girls of African descent that were tortured, mutilated, without anesthesia. Nothing that talks about what they contributed, forcibly, of course.
No mention of them either in a well-known painting immortalizing Sims as the father of modern gynecology. Michelle Browder first saw it as an art student 3 decades ago.
I was triggered. From there, I had promised myself that one day I will change that narrative.
Got the welding station.
A promise renewed years later when she moved to Montgomery and discovered the statue at the Capitol.
I was horrified. I still am. If he's the father of gynecology, the father of modern gynecology, then where are the mothers?
Browder decided she'd do something about it. Relying heavily on Sims' own notes, she focused on the only 3 women actually named in his writings. Today, about a mile from the Sims Monument, are soaring, wrought iron tributes to the women she calls the mothers of gynecology, Anarcha, Betsy, and Lucy.
They didn't have autonomy, so it just makes sense for them not to have arms and feet.
The young women endured months of trial and error as Sims honed his technique to repair their fistulas. The humiliating vaginal injury, usually caused by obstructed labor, renders women incontinent and unable to bear children.
If you see around her legs there, that wire represents the silk suture, sutures that he used to basically torture them. And then, of course, Betsy, her crown, is made up of the speculum.
The first time that I ever viewed the monument, I cried, and I didn't know exactly why.
Lauren Marcel and Alana Taylor are local artists and recent transplants to Montgomery. They were on the day's tour.
just seeing that work erected in such a way as a healing device was beautiful.
The only thing that differentiates us from these women is time.
If it's outlawed in 1808, that we cannot go back and traffic folks from Africa, then where are we getting these people?
From the neighborhood?
Breeding plantations. Breeding.
Black women's, their wombs are the engines that maintain the institution of slavery.
Deidre Cooper Owens is a medical historian and author. As for anesthesia, she says, it was not commonly used in Sims' day. But his reason for avoiding it rested on a widely held stereotype that black people do not feel pain, something contradicted, she says, in his own work.
I call it racial cognitive dissonance. He holds on to the ideologies or sets of beliefs that are swirling in the 19th century, that black people are somehow different than white people biologically. But he'll write, you know, this patient lost sense of herself and struggled violently as we had to restrain her during surgery. Why would you need to restrain a black patient who is insensible to pain?
And you look at today, that even with all the advancements that we have, that African-American women tend to have higher mortality and morbidity, and I think it's just a trickle down from the troubles that our ancestors had to endure.
Latoya Clark, a Montgomery obstetrician-gynecologist, says anti-black stereotypes have endured through the years. Even today, she notes, studies find many providers believe African Americans feel less pain, that their complaints are exaggerated. The flip side, she says, is deep distrust of the healthcare system.
Do you have patients who actively want to see you because they think you're more culturally competent, because they think that you would better understand their predicament?
Yes, I've had numerous patients that say that I've seen a man gynecologist all my life and now I want to see a female gynecologist, or I wanted to come to an African-American gynecologist.
Browder says she's faced occasional pushback in this deep red state where Sims is revered for work that was indeed groundbreaking.
I've had some doctors say that I'm actually trying to stain this man's reputation, who's actually done something good, he was a man of his time. In any case, whether or not he was a man of his time, then his time was barbaric, and therefore he was barbaric. So let's start there, and then seek out ways to help and repair what's just broken.
And then there have been moments of grace, notably after she explained her plans for the new center to the white owners of the building.
She says, oh, Michelle, just little Miss Gone with the Wind. She was like, we're just so proud of you. And if you're going to do all of that, we're going to let you have that building for $35,000.
Not what you expected.
Just don't judge the book by the cover.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Montgomery, Alabama.
It is graduation season, and that means politicians, actors, and even someone from the NewsHour you might recognize are imparting sage advice and encouragement to college graduates around the country. Here are some of the life lessons this year's commencement speakers passed on to 2023 graduates.
A few classes. Once in every several generations enters at a point in our history where it actually has a chance to change the trajectory of the country. You face that inflection point today. And I know you'll meet the moment. I just think about the many ways you already have.
Everything extraordinary in my life came from the wandering. And that's not to say I didn't work hard and that you shouldn't work hard, but don't work hard to acquire things. Work hard so that you can buy yourself the time to wander easy. Use whatever skills you have to carve out days of randomness and adventure.
When you find yourself in unfamiliar situations, taking on new responsibilities, perhaps under challenging circumstances, find a way to do that thing outside of the law that grounds you. Whether it's ultimate frisbee or painting or going to the theater.
Love is always about taking action, not just words. Love is always about support and help. Never ask yourself, shall I help? ask yourself, how can I help?
Happy is not something that is given to us by others. It is a choice that we get to make every day. So why don't I ask you to look up? Look up at the sky, the clouds, beyond the sun, the moon, the stars, when you need to recharge your spirit. Let the gravity of Earth give you a warm hug when you're feeling low.
I know hope can feel like a really wishy-washy word, right? It's all rainbows and butterflies and big dreams, but I am here to tell you it is not. Hope is a verb. Hope is strength. Hope is resilience. I see it every day in the stories I cover in all parts of the world, in every corner of this country, in moments where all seems lost. Hope is the bridge between what is and what will be.
When the path ahead is obscured and unclear, you can find your way by resolving to do the next right thing. And you will almost always know what that is. There is a small voice inside telling you. It's your conscience. Listen to it.
For the sake of this world, become peacemakers. It is better to be at peace than to prove to anyone that you are right. Work with peace in your heart. Find peace in your soul, and everything else will follow.
It's your time now to leave this home and began to create a life that you will call your own. It's all part of carving out your individual paths as purposeful, whole human beings. So now, if someone says to you that you are doing too much, you tell them, I'm just getting started. Thank you again for this tremendous honor, and congratulations.
Online, you can also hear from students who are graduating from high school about their hopes for the future. That's at pbs.org/newshour.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us.